owner only, but I'll be glad to ask him if he'd like me to look into that. I just don't want to leave you with any misimpression as to type of questions I can respond to.
I should have. That should be shown in the record as a part of the inquiry on House Bill 2520. But we will continue in work session on 2324. Representative Dix.
I was just going to reiterate what Ms. Streisinger just pointed out, that she serves as the counsel to the governor, and Mr. Taylor and legislative counsel serve as counsel to this committee. In fact, Ms. Streisinger might have a different opinion as to Mr. Taylor with regard to a subject, and Mr. Taylor may have a different opinion, and legislative counsel might have a different opinion.
And Virginia Vanderbilt might even have a different opinion.
That's true. But she serves as the counsel for the governor, and certainly we could make that request to the governor, and then maybe he could see fit to have you review that section.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor.
Sure.
Let's go back to the bill and fill us in on where we're at.
Try to tell you Section 39, but you've already told me you wouldn't believe that, so. I believe we're in Section 13, where we left off.
It's not in the record.
Maybe we could ask Donna Ray to come up, too. So we can use the tag team. Dr. Bray, yeah.
Dr. Bray. Where did I lose him? Dr. Bray.
For the record, I'm Don Bray, Assistant Administrator of the Mental Health Division.
Section 13, Council.
Okay, sure. Section 13, I think the most important part of Section 13, I direct your attention to line 29 of 13, and I'll go back to the other part of it later. This relates to privilege. ORS 40.230 and 40.235 are the privilege sections relating to physician, patient, and psychotherapist client. This section would allow certain testimony in that is not being currently allowed. From what I have been told by the investigators in the field and people who work in the area, this and going back to a couple of the, I think section 1 and 2 are the most important sections of the bill. These sections will make it easier to introduce evidence that's needed to determine whether someone should be committed or not. Okay, in addition, it also, top of the page on the bill, it also sets forth the consistency provision of 5 days of judicial days for a hold.
So far as Section 13 goes, then, in conjunction with an earlier section that's a part of the procedure that, although, as I recall, there were some objections by the ACLU in our original testimony, allows limited additional evidence on the commitment hearings. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Is there a discussion of the committee, or does the committee wish to pursue other alternatives than this for this particular proposal from the interim task force? Objection to the concept. Hearing none, why don't we move on to the next section?
Okay. That would be Section 14, Mr. Chairman. That's found on page 11, starting on line 6. And this is a section that deals with a warning to the person who may or may not be mentally ill. And this is the traditional, as known to most people, Miranda warning. And this would set forth in statute that the person has a right to a counsel, that they have a right to their rights, and they have a right to remain silent, etc. I guess one interesting side issue on this is if a person is getting his Miranda warning and is mentally ill, are they capable of understanding it? But I think it's something that should be given anyways, and then if anything is said at that hearing and it wants to be introduced into evidence, then that's a question a judge would have to determine at the time.
If I recall, our Court of Appeals has spoken on the issue of whether or not somebody totally inebriated got a valid Miranda warning and answered that question affirmatively. I don't know what precedential value that would have in this case, but be that as it may, comments on the section. Representative Dix.
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked at the court case, nor has it pointed out in my employer, but it seems an inebriation and some kind of mental handicap are two different things, and I would imagine that I don't know what basis the court used in that ruling.
Well, my opinion was it wasn't a real good basis, whatever it was, and I'm not trying to say that the states are equivalent either, but I think the legal issue presented was the capacity to understand the warning as to whether or not it was adequately given. The right to a lawyer is already, I mean, this codifies the right to a lawyer. They already do have a right to a lawyer.
Yes.
I don't think it helps us. I think that's a situation that you're going to run into on a case-by-case basis, no matter what we do here. And it wouldn't help the situation for us to attempt to remove the right from the statute since it exists.
You know, it was added by case law, in fact.
Mm. So it exists in law.
Are there other parts of Section 14, Counsel?
I think that's pretty much it. Unless Mr. Bray would like to add something.
Dr. Bray?
Yes, Section 14 also addresses the problem of the state's interest not being represented and requires...
You're talking about Section 4 and thereafter?
Yes.
Okay, that is a separate part. Let me ask first, does anybody have any objection to Section 14 down through sub 4? Hearing none, we'll move on to that. And Dr. Bray, do you want to describe perhaps the representation of the state's interest, even the fiscal implications of those?
The problem that was presented to the task force was that in many instances the state's interest is not represented at the hearing by the district attorney or the recommitment hearing by anybody. This was an attempt to remedy that. The fiscal impact of that would be $57,000 for costs. Excuse me, I'm looking at the wrong one here. $104,000 for costs to the Attorney General's office and $313,000 costs for county district attorneys to participate.
What was the $104,000 for the AG and what? $104,000 is for a two-year period?
Yes. These are both biennial figures and $313,000.
Did you give us a figure on the DAs?
I did. And for the district attorneys, $313,740. Was our estimate.
313 is what would be passed on to who? Is that the state's cost for DAs?
The she's probably nodding yes.
That was a strong negative.
I should have eyes.
The additional state cost would be $104,000 for the AG. The DA's budget is primarily tax supported, property tax supported, if I recall. And the additional $313,000 would primarily fall on the local governmental entities. Discussion. I'll start it off. I would think, and I believe we had the local district attorney here talk on this issue as to the sub 5, if the district attorney didn't appear, the court may order the state to pay the cost of the hearing. Out of monies the state holds for payment to the DA's salaries. I do recall the district attorney on behalf of the DA's had a rather immediate negative reaction to that provision. That is, counsel, is sub 5 the penalty provision only? Does this subsection elsewhere require them to appear?
In relation to, I believe section 5 goes to the district attorneys, and it does talk about withholding money from state funds to pay the district attorney's salary. I believe the section above relates to, I also believe the attorney general's in here somewhere. Yes, at the top of line 3 at page 12, the Attorney General's office shall have responsibility rating proceedings, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me just restate it. Sub 5 is the penalty provision. The DA has to appear under little b further up the page, but sub 5 is the penalty provision only.
Correct.
That would be my thought on this, that we would want to, if committee members will recall, in these proceedings, we come up where there is no representation of the state interest. We come up against a situation where the person that makes the decision, that is the judge, at times becomes part DA, part AG, developing the record for the record. And I think that I approve of these sections as chair of this committee. However, District Attorney Penn brought up a good point as to where you hold the gun when they don't do what they're told to do by statute. And that gun was pointed directly at the DA's head under the penalty provision. So I would support us encouraging very strongly for the AG and the DAs to appear in every proceeding. Not strongly enough, though, to leave sub 5 in, which is the penalty provision.
So you don't like sub 5?
I don't like sub 5.
Because of the costs involved for the DAs or the penalty provision?
Because I think we should have a policy statement in there that the DAs and the AG appear at every time they possibly can, but at the same time, I think we should allow other remedies to take place without docking the district attorney for not appearing. What I'm saying is these issues really are state issues on the 100,000 and local government issues on the 312,000 every 2 years. And for us to pick out a DA when there are county commissioners involved and others involved on the funding aspects and penalize that DA is something that I'm not willing to, I don't think we should promote. I'd like to hear from other committee members on this. I support the interim committees or the task force trying to put somebody to represent the state's interest at every one of these hearings. I don't know where the heck you got that penalty provision.
It was recommended by a task force member, and I can't recall which one. the task force was most solidly on the first point that there should be, the state's case should be represented. The penalty clause was not a significant, in my memory, element, but there was a lot of discussion about the fact that people do not show up and a desire to find some way to put some sort of a mechanism to make sure that they did.
Well, let's get off the dime. The chair would move deletion of sub 5. Is there an objection to that? Hearing none, so ordered. Any other comments on 5? With that, let's go. Let's back up for a minute. Council, based on the representation of the Governor's Council and all of the information we have from the AG's office and working through 2324, let's move back to page 5.
Sure. Chairman.
Chairman. Would move the deletion of the expanded criteria on page 5. Comments? Representative Bellamy?
How do you know I was going to comment? What are we looking at?
Section 5.
We're looking at the
expanded criteria.
The
whole thing. What about sub 5?
Section 3, the amendment that was alcohol that happens to go
down. What is sub 5 doing?
Sub 5 is expanded. Is this one right here?
Mr. Chair. Representative Dix.
We were just making a motion regarding the new language in the bill.
You look at Section 5 on pages 4 and 5, and I think with the exception of subsection 5 in sub 5, the rest of the new language in Section 5 is equivalent to the expanded criteria. Wouldn't that be correct, Dr. Bray?
Say again, I'm not with you on which line. Sub?
Pages 4 and 5, Section 5.
Okay, I've got that. And
the expanded criteria is all of Section 5, new language in Section 5, except sub 5 of 5. Is that
right.
correct?
I agree. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, the chair would place the motion then to delete all of Section 5 as new language except subsection 5. Representative Bellamy. Discussion.
Well, I'm just going to vote no, Mr. Chair. I think I discussed it plenty at the last time.
Well,
Representative.
Perhaps Representative Bellamy can enlighten me because I don't recall that discussion.
Well,
just briefly, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just don't believe if we don't look at the expanded criteria that there's as much value to the bill. I have since been counseled and lobbied to indicate there's a lot of other things in the bill, but I think I'm willing to take the chance on a court test for the expanded criteria.
Other commentary? Representative Miller?
No, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Speak with my vote.
I would like to make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
I know that there are people who have worked on this who are disappointed by the motion. I'm going to support the motion because of the legal information that's come in front of the committee regarding what the likely result of a constitutional challenge would be. I think that there are many important other elements in the bill, and I'd like to handle this and get on with them so that we can move this through the process quickly and successfully.
I agree with Representative Bauman. We had the Attorney General's counsel in here suggesting that in state court they might be successful. I guess in federal court they wouldn't be. Certainly if I were going to file a suit, perhaps they wouldn't be as successful in federal court. I would certainly look at court selection in that process. And the other thing I'm concerned about is every time the Attorney General's office comes in here and suggests that they can, in fact, defend a question, constitutional question, there is never any discussion, nor did we ask, about the cost to the state in that particular. Maybe counsel raises his hand at this point. The cost, the potential cost to the state. Also, there have been other cases that have been tested where that office has had to come back to either the e-board for more funds or Ways and Means the following session. So I think we're just asking to spend taxpayer dollars on a question that perhaps can be resolved in some other way. So I guess I am not interested in a court test.
Mr. Young.
I think counsel may have some information concerning costs.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just before the meeting, the hearing, I spoke with Mr. Young from the AG's office, the Attorney General's office, about this very fact, about costs. And they were talking about costs, and please correct me if I'm wrong, of about $8,000 to $9,000 for the Ninth Circuit Court. The Ninth Circuit Court has looked at this issue and on Suzuki case, and under Suzuki and the Attorney General's belief that the criteria that we have come up with is unconstitutional. They have argued that maybe the Ninth Circuit will change their mind. We're talking, I think, more realistically of going to the Supreme Court of the United States, and I understand the cost would run somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000. Is that correct? So we're probably talking in a legal fee somewhere between $40,000 and $60,000.
I think in addition to that, there's a time thing that would be involved on review within the Supreme Court too. Representative Dix.
Once again, maybe you could tell me what the process is. If we pass a bill and I'm a citizen and I think the bill is unconstitutional, where would I file that case?
Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dix, in reading Suzuki, and what I would do in talking to other people that practice in the area, I would bring a writ of habeas corpus in the U.S. District Court, because that's how Suzuki wound up in the U.S. District Court in Hawaii. Talking to Mr. Young, we both agreed that the district court would be bound by the Ninth Circuit decision. Mr. Young was informing me that they would set forth most of their legal arguments in the district court and then carry those arguments over to the Ninth Circuit. Yes, any plaintiff's attorney who's familiar with the area, and a couple of them were sitting out here last week, are aware of the fact that they go to the district court, they're going to have to apply Ninth Circuit law, which is Suzuki. If they go to the Oregon State Court, then the court may look at the federal decision, it may also look at other state decisions. But if I were to bring suit, and I think anyone who's familiar with the bring suit, I would bring it in the U.S. District Court.
The budget...
Representative Dix.
The discussion you had with the Attorney General's office, is that inside? Have they planned on spending that money? Is that within their budget right now?
We did not talk about that. We were talking actually a ballpark figure.
Right, no, I understand that. I'm not to hold anybody to facts and figures. I was just curious if that was in their request for this biennium.
To my knowledge, there has been no request. Mr. Young can correct me if I'm wrong. Shake his head.
Dr. Gray.
I could answer. The Mental Health Division would budget for that because they bill us for the services, and it is not included in our budget. It was not at the time of our budget, we didn't realize that we had a constitutional problem or a potential problem here, so it was not included. But there is a budget for attorney general fees that's a general budget that anticipates the kind of problem that the division's now facing at Fairview or and other situations. So there is a budget for such items.
So the way that it would be paid for would be the attorney general would bill the mental health division for this suit.
And the mental health division does have a budget without fully anticipating all of the things that are going to happen. So it was, the budget was not specifically tied to this item, but we do have a budget for attorney general's fees.
That rests in a discussion for another day on the way that we allocate funds to the attorney general's office. So I just wanted to note that we hadn't had that discussion previous, and I appreciate counsel getting the ballpark figures from the attorney general's office.
There's a motion before us. Further discussion. Oh, Representative Miller, did you have a question? I missed you there a minute ago.
Just an observation, Mr. Chairman, that a number of committees I've been on last several terms, and when sometimes we have some difficult questions, we start talking about somebody may take this to court or somebody screams this is unconstitutional, and sometimes they might be, and sometimes they might not be. And I certainly am aware of the costs involved in pursuing those things, but I can appreciate Representative Bellamy's position that he's interested in doing what is the best policy, and I think he might find that it is defensible. And I can't predict what the Circuit Court's going to do, and I can't predict what the U.S. Supreme Court's going to do, or for that matter, who's going to be on it in the next term. So I'll just go ahead and vote on the section. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would think that who's going to be on it would have little to do with considering we have high-quality justices.
I
have
some new opinions get appointed from time to time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bauman.
I do have a question for counsel that to address Representative Miller's comment. And it seemed to me that there was some fairly chilling exposure to liability, other than just the determination of the question, is this constitutional, based upon both the Attorney General's letter and the Suzuki case. And I wonder if counsel could just in 25 words or less clarify that for me for the record right now, because I do think do you recall what I'm talking about, counsel?
I do. I don't know whether any lawyer can give you any opinion on the 25 words, but I'll try.
I think we're talking about, and once again, Mr. Young has anything to add, by all means do so. We're talking about Harlow v. Fitzgerald and the federal case law, and that's a case which, if I remember correctly, is a 1982 case in which the court held that if a government official acted in good faith reliance upon the statute, then he would be free from liability from suit. I assume it would be a 1983 suit. The issue that becomes involved, I think, with the opinion letter was that some people raised was whether the fact that the opinion letter would put the mental health to people on notice of the constitutional problems with the expanded criteria. That may be what you're referring to. That was pointed out to me, and when I looked at it, it does make sense. The fact that you're stating in the opinion letter that it may be unconstitutional, and you're setting forth the case law, and you're setting forth the fact that it would be difficult, and I'm talking about the first letter, I believe it's April 8th, that it would be difficult to withstand court challenge in the Ninth Circuit, then you're now raising the issue of whether any state official has a good faith reliance upon the statute because of the opinion letter. Now, the subsequent opinion letter that we just got, I believe it's dated April 28th, sets forth in more detail and sets forth with more facts why they believe that even in federal court there may be a chance of winning. I mean, I believe they come up and state that there's a reasonable chance of winning, and very well that letter may serve as greater protection for any state official acting on the Attorney General's advice. It could get messy.
Okay. Are there further comments on the motion before us?
Well,
Representative Dix.
I wasn't completely clear on the answer from Bill on that. I wasn't completely clear in your answer. I mean, I wasn't able to focus and develop the answer that I wanted with your answer. Is there any way you could summarize it?
Representative Dix, will you restate the question concisely, and Mr. Taylor, will you restate the answer concisely?
Well, Representative Bauman asked the question regarding a fairly serious exposure and liability, and I wasn't able to ascertain an answer from counsel's answer as to Representative Bauman's question. Is that clear enough, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, let me try one more time, Representative Dix. Okay. A public official, in carrying out his duties, may have liability, particularly if he does not act in compliance with statutory provisions, statutory law. He may even have liability if he does